members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. When we think of a time in history or a place in geography, we rarely think how these places and events are connected. We have with us today Dr. Glenn Cooper, professor of history at Brigham Young University. Dr. Cooper, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Marilee.
However, you weren't always studying history, were you?
No, actually I wasn't. I started off in physics, in mathematical physics. I actually come from a well-known LDS scientist family. In brief, Harvey Fletcher and Carl Eyring are my uncles. And I was very proud of that, and I wanted to follow their example as a scientist. But as I got into it and I probed the origins of things and tried to understand quantum mechanics and all of those theories of everything about subatomic particles and all this, at the same time I was learning languages. And I had learned several languages before I went on my mission, which was a Chinese-speaking mission, which just added another feather to my linguistic cap. I came to understand that no theory can explain the individual. No theory can explain beauty or the subtleties of human culture. And so when I realized that and also started to take philosophy courses, that sounded the death knell of my career in the sciences, because I was much more interested in the particularities of human cultures and civilizations. And my desire to understand the origins of things took me into history. And specifically history of science, because I do come from a science background. I don't apologize for that. So,
in fact, what originally caught my eye about you was your doctoral study on ancient Greek and medieval medicine. So obviously you are still kind of combining your interest in science with history, but it appears your interest goes a little further than that. You mentioned in our communications the importance of Greek thought or Hellenism. Would you like to expound on that?
Oh, I'd be delighted. I love to talk about this in my classes till the students' eyes glaze over sometimes. But I'm concerned with the legacy of Greek thought to the world. And what I mean by this is what has sometimes been called the Greek miracle. In the 5th century, 5th and 4th century BC, something rather amazing happened in ancient Athens. Philosophy and science were invented. And this is because of a particular collocation of societal factors, economic factors, as well as that certain je ne sais quoi, you know, the things that you can't explain, that came together in this particular time and place. And thinkers like Plato and Aristotle invented a new way of thinking about things, asking questions, philosophical questions. And for the first time, we had a scientific understanding where people tried to systematically understand tradition, systematically understand nature and the universe, instead of being content with, say, religious explanations or superstitious explanations. And this way of thinking became quite infectious, and it spread through the lands that Alexander the Great conquered. It's called Hellenism. What it really is the amalgam of Greek language, philosophy, Greek societal elements that spread all the way to the borders of India and unified this region in a particular way. It also influenced the Roman Empire when the Romans conquered the western part of this. It also spread later on into the Islamic world and made the Golden Age of Islam possible by providing this new religion with a way of talking about their theology and talking about their religion in a systematic manner.
And being able to share.
Yes.
Because I know that was one of the big important things with Islam is their ability to share and their ability to travel through, because, you know, Muhammad he started out as a merchant.
That's right.
And so, so how then we're talking about the spreading of this, how then was Greek thought kept alive through this spread? I mean, what was going on?
That's a really important question because the Greek Empire of Alexander, well, it's a Macedonian Empire, but the Greek culture fell eventually and was subjugated by other forces. Every civilization that we know of from the ancient world didn't last forever. The political entities collapsed, fell apart. But the ideas, the texts, the philosophical and scientific texts did manage to survive. And they were approached at various times by individuals, say, in Islam, in the Byzantine world, later on in Western Europe during the High Middle Ages. They were approached by individuals who wanted to learn more, and there was a societal need for them to gain these tools as well. And so it makes sense to talk about a series of renaissances. The society, the intellectual world was reawakened to these ancient Hellenistic ways of thinking. In fact, there actually is a big break between the period that we know of as late antiquity with the fall of the Roman Empire and the reawakening of or the Renaissance in Islam in the 9th century. There's really a discontinuity. The philosophical tradition died out during that period. There was no tradition from teacher to student that carried all the way into the Islamic world. The situation in the Byzantine Empire didn't permit that. The empire was involved in a civil war and theological turmoil and so on. And so when the thinkers of Islam encountered Hellenism for the first time, they didn't have teachers that could teach them the way that they were supposed to learn Plato and Aristotle through the ancient traditional schools. You know, they were very, 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 very traditional, very, very set in their ways about thinking about you were either a Stoic or a Platonist or an Aristotelian and so on. So the Islamic thinkers didn't have that, and they just had the texts, and they took what they needed for their specific problems, a sort of a potpourri, and created something new, entirely new and fascinating, which has influenced us today in a very important way, in a way that we couldn't have gotten straight from the Greeks.
So we go from the Greeks.
Yes.
And then the Roman Empire then absorbs that way of thinking in those schools.
Yes.
And so hence we get Hellenism that spreads all throughout the Mediterranean.
Yes.
Because wherever the Romans went, they took this with us. And that had a real strong impact on the New Testament that we have today, right?
Yes, very much.
And so, but then the Roman Empire fell. Mm-hmm. And then these few centuries later, the Islamic nations pick it up again, but with a completely different tradition.
Yes, yes, and I'm just talking about this in a brief. There's a couple of more missing pieces I just need to describe quickly. The Roman Empire fell in the West, but it survived in the East. And the differences between the two halves of the empire were largely linguistic and also cultural. The Western Empire was Latin.
That was Rome in Italy.
Right. Rome, France, Britain, Spain, and North Africa were pretty much part of the West. In the East, the Eastern Mediterranean, that whole area was Greek, Greek-speaking, Greek culture. The Hellenism took root there. That's why the New Testament was originally written in Greek, or at least the version that we have. And so the Greek culture continued in that region, even though Greek thought, Greek philosophy, died out because of the civil war and so on that took place. But there's another group of people in the Middle East, the Christians, Syriac-speaking Christians, who belonged to a group of or a type of Christianity that was considered heretical by the main forms. And they were very, very interested in Hellenism and in philosophy and theology, and they kept it alive, and science and medicine, and they kept it alive in that area through the dark period. And so when Islam becomes interested in this in the beginning of the 8th century and the 9th century, there's already people there, Christians, Syriac-speaking Christians, not Greek ones, but Syriac-speaking Christians who can read Greek, who have access to Aristotle and Galen and all the rest. And so they provide the texts to the Islamic thinkers, but the Islamic thinkers have their own research agendas. And so there's not really a continuity with the ancient Roman, Greco-Roman schools. It's something new.
And what was that newness? What was that newness that Islam applied to these texts?
Well, I think the newness, there's a real parallel, I think, between Islam and the LDS tradition. From the very beginning, Muslims were enjoined by their prophet to seek knowledge even unto China, to seek knowledge wherever they could find it. It was an intellectually hungry civilization, as proved by the fact that they achieved such greatness in every area of science and philosophy over the next few centuries. They were hungry for knowledge. They sought out of the best books wherever they could find knowledge. And so you have in the history of science, you have a way of thinking about the development of science in terms of problems and solutions. And a thinker has a problem, and to solve that problem, he's going to go wherever he can find the bits and pieces that he needs to do this. And it's better if he doesn't belong to an ossified, restrictive, constraining tradition that's going to limit his thought. And that's what happened with these Islamic thinkers. They weren't straitjacketed, at least in the beginning.
They didn't necessarily have this school of discipline and you follow and do it this way.
Not in the beginning, no.
They didn't have that. So how far-reaching was that influence? I mean, we've talked about that influence going into the Islamic world. Did it go beyond that? I mean, at that particular – well, of course, obviously it would have because Islam was traveling all over the place.
Yes. Yes. And that's a really great question too, because the Islamic world unified – a geographical region extending from Spain to India.
Wow.
Spain across North Africa, and for 200 years, Sicily was included. Egypt, Syria, the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, and farther east into Central Asia and to the borders of India. All of this was under one religion, one culture, even though not necessarily united politically the whole time. Scholars could travel the whole length and breadth of it, exchange their ideas, exchange texts. It's really one of the most remarkable empires in history from this vantage point. And the great legacy that I think that we should be concerned about in the West, the legacy of Islam, is that what they created intellectually and and scientifically in Baghdad in the 9th century, in what I and my colleagues are fond to call the first Renaissance. The first Western Renaissance occurred in Baghdad with the reinvention of science. That legacy was bequeathed to Europe in the beginning – or the High Middle Ages beginning in the 11th century. And what we understand as science and philosophy really has an Islamic cast to it. It's not like we got our science and philosophy directly from the Greco-Romans. We got it through the prism, through the lens, through the creative hands of Islam that manipulated it and fashioned it into something that was very, very useful. And so we have, as a result of that, the invention of modern science during the Middle Ages. We have thinkers in Europe that are doing experiments. They're doing things that we would recognize as modern in a scientific way.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Mormon Channel. You're listening to Insights. Our guest today is Dr. Glenn Cooper, professor of history at Brigham Young University. So while Europe was experiencing what we call the Dark Ages, obviously, there was this flowering, this burgeoning that was happening in the Middle East. What empire was flourishing in the Middle East at this time?
Well, you've got two empires. We have the Islamic Empire that I've been talking about, established in the 7th century, but really the one that I refer to most was the Abbasid Empire established in Baghdad in 750. But the second empire maintains a continuity culturally with the ancient Rome, and that is what we now call the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire is actually the Eastern Roman Empire as it survived from ancient times. There's a political continuity between Augustus, the first Roman emperor, all the way on down to the Middle Ages when the empire was destroyed. There's a succession of emperors through that whole period, although the empire itself was dramatically transformed. You wouldn't recognize its Romanness by the time of the Middle Ages. Hence, it makes sense to talk about Byzantine. And the main difference was that it became Christian. It was a Christian Roman Empire. And so Augustus certainly wouldn't have recognized the icons of Christ as...
Well, it was founded by Emperor Constantine.
Constantine did, in fact, favor Christianity and gave the Christian cast to this political entity that was already there, of course.
And so it was called, the capital was Constantinople.
Right. Or the New Rome.
Yeah.
And so the Byzantines did manage to keep Greek thought alive to a certain degree. They had other concerns, primarily theological and political. And so the civil war that I was talking about that sort of limited the intellectual heritage of Hellenism in the Byzantine world was actually known as iconoclasm. It's a war over icons and what role these images should play in the church. The empire itself had suffered tremendous reverses, military reverses against Islam. It lost two-thirds of its territory in a very short time, which got swallowed up by the Islamic Empire. This created economic and social turmoil in the empire, and so their concerns were introspective. They weren't interested in metaphysical scientific questions or philosophical questions. They were interested in questions of salvation, questions of why is God allowing this to happen to his chosen people? We are, after all, the kingdom of God on the earth. We have Christianity. We have all of this stuff. And so while Western Europe was languishing in the Dark Ages, Byzantium had a high civilization and a Christian civilization, a great deal of wealth. It lost its primary interest in its own intellectual heritage. Islam in Baghdad was – they had the ball. They were the ones that were leaders in science and philosophy for these few centuries. And then they are the ones who set the example for everybody else. The Byzantines finally got their – got their act together, and beginning in the 9th century, they turned their attention again to science and philosophy, and so we have another renaissance occurring within that civilization. But by the time that happened, they are actually imitating and following the example of the Muslims.
And so you're calling that first renaissance was the one that happened in Baghdad.
Yeah.
The second one is the one that happens in Constantinople and within the Byzantine Empire.
That's right. And there's at least four others before the one, including the one that we normally think of.
So then how did this – so this Greek thought then is moving through the Islamic Empire, and now it finally moves into the Byzantine Empire. How did it influence – the Byzantine Empire?
Well, that's actually the subject of my current research. So I'm not able to make any sweeping pronouncement at this point. But it seems that the Byzantines did, in fact, have access to their ancient texts. There's no doubt about that. They didn't lose Galen and Aristotle and so on. What they lost was people to read them. So for about a century and a half, nobody was reading them or copying them. What they seem to have gotten from the Islamic world was a revived interest in these things. There was a very painful awareness by the time of the 9th century that the Muslims, these enemies of ours, are these infidels, you know, they are outstripping us in our own tradition. We need to look back to what we have. And so that's primarily, I think, what the legacy of Islam to the Byzantine Empire. However, there's also evidence that physicians and astrologers accompanied these embassies between the Islamic world and the Byzantine world. They seem to have brought intellectuals along with them. And so the recent research seems to indicate that not only were there political exchanges involving diplomatic concerns and exchanges of prisoners and so on occurring throughout the period of the Byzantine-Arab wars, but there was also intellectual exchanges. There were text exchanges. The intellectuals talked with one another. And ironically, I think the astrologers were at the forefront of this exchange of knowledge because astrology had such a premium at the time.
And we'll get to that in a minute. But I'd like to know, while Byzantium was flourishing, what actually was happening in Rome? What was happening in Italy?
And again, that's a very important question. And my students always want to know if the Roman Empire is surviving in the East, what happened to the original Rome? Well, the original Rome became a backwater. It was neglected. Rome is not – I mean, let's face it. Rome is not located in a very advantageous place.
Not strategically placed.
No, it's not placed to be the capital of a world empire. That's why in later times the capital was moved up to places like Ravenna and Milan, which is closer to the north than the Roman
the trade
roads.
Routes.
Yeah, right. And so Rome got neglected, but the church, the Catholic Church, or what became the Catholic Church, flourished there. And so what happens during this critical period of late antiquity is with the political vacuum, the absence of political empire in the region, the Pope steps in and assumes political authority. And it makes sense because he's the only power that unifies the region. I mean the Western Empire had fragmented into smaller proto-nations that were ruled by Germanic tribes and other barbarians. And the only thing they had in common was Christianity. And in some cases, that's even a stretch because for a time, many of these areas were under Arian Christianity, which was a heresy. Okay, so the Pope unifies this. The Pope assumes all kinds of political authority and essentially becomes the emperor. And it's interesting to note that the Pope actually among his titles are many of these ancient titles that were originally attached to the emperor. And this is a problem for Eastern Christianity because originally the Pope was just one of a brotherhood of bishops that ruled the church in councils together. But because of what happened in the Middle Ages, the Pope acquired all this authority and power. And I mean, history has shown that whenever an institution acquires power and authority, it's very difficult for them to shed it.
Yeah.
And so one of the bones of contention between the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholics today is that the Pope has too much authority that is unwarranted for a brother bishop.
So how did Europe finally crawl out of these dark ages and begin to enjoy an age of enlightenment? How did the Renaissance finally come to Europe?
Well, it's a series of multiple factors. During the early Middle Ages, what we call the Middle Ages in the West, economically, Europe lagged way behind everywhere else. You had barbarian tribes. You had the Magyars coming in from Central Asia. You've got the Vikings causing havoc in the West. And there's no central authority to really protect people. So you have the development of feudalism with local warlords that are able to extend protection to people. And so you have no centralization. Now, as time goes on, there becomes a greater centralization and greater economic prosperity. And so we're talking about the year 1000 to 1100. And with the proximity of Spain, the Christian kingdoms in Spain, to Islamic Spain, and the Norman conquest of Sicily, which conquered Sicily from the Arabs but didn't destroy Arab culture, preserved Arabic administration, preserved a close relationship with Arabic intellectuals. The greatest of the kings of Norman kings of Sicily was actually also Holy Roman Emperor. His name was Frederick II. He died in 1250, but he was fluent in Latin, German, French, Greek, and Arabic. All these languages. He cultivated this court. Anyway, Western Europe became very interested in the science and the philosophy again and began to translate, under the auspices of the church actually, began to translate texts from Arabic that had been translated from Greek. So they first got their Aristotle from this two slots removed from the original. And the motivation, at least originally, was to train scholars who could be theologians, who could serve the papal court, and who could teach at the universities and train more priests. But then what happened after about a century of first encounters with this ancient stuff, it got out of hand because they began to thinkers began to discover things in Aristotle that were incompatible with Christian thought. And the church tried to rein it in, but they couldn't. And so you had these independent thinkers who were actually developing scientific ways of thinking. The greatest achievement, though, however, was Thomas Aquinas, who did manage, however, to show the church that there was a way of looking, a way of using Aristotle that was not threatening to the church. You'd had to play down certain aspects of it and sort of metaphorize and metaphysicize certain other areas, and then you're fine. But the cat was already out of the bag in a sense, and so we already have the beginnings of a secular kind of scientific thinking in the middle to late Middle Ages that would form the core of the Renaissance.
You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. We're discussing history with Dr. Glenn Cooper, professor of history at Brigham Young University. So we've been talking about the various different kinds of Renaissance that there were. And I was reading through one of your articles, and it was interesting how, you know, we've talked about the Baghdad Renaissance. We've talked about the Renaissance in Byzantium, Constantinople. But what happened to get that Renaissance into Italy and then finally into Europe? And I think you made an interesting connection I hadn't thought about before, that it actually comes from Byzantium. Is that right?
Yeah. It's the Renaissance that we normally think of with, and I like to tell my students that's the Renaissance with a capital R. There are fancy ways to refer to it, you know, the Quattrocento and the various ways that Renaissance scholars refer to it. That particular one was given a tremendous boost by Byzantine scholars that were essentially fleeing their decaying empire from Constantinople into Italy. The empire was, of course, destroyed around 1453 when Constantinople was captured by the Turks. But it was clear for about a century before that the end was inevitable. And the situation in Italy and the Italian city-states was such, economically they had some prosperity, I mean a great deal of prosperity actually, beginning in the 14th century, scholars became interested in the Greek legacy. First of all, they started studying their Latin. They read their Cicero, they read their Virgil and others, and they discovered that Cicero referred to all of these Greek authors and thoughts, and they began to wonder, well, you know, where are they? Well, it just so happens that in Constantinople, there was a whole society that had access to this stuff, and people spoke Greek, well, with the by a slight stretch, it was a different sort. It was medieval Greek, but they spoke Greek as a living language, and so they began to hire Byzantine scholars to come over to Italy and teach their circles, teach circles of intellectuals Greek. So they started to read Homer, and Plato became a wildfire in the minds of a number of Renaissance thinkers, especially in Florence. And so this is the part of the Renaissance with a capital R that has a Greek cast to it. It comes from Byzantium. However, I've been talking about a series of Renaissances that occurred, you know, Baghdad, Byzantium, then there were at least two or three in Europe, including the Carolingian Renaissance under Charlemagne, and then a couple – the 11th century and the 12th century Renaissances. All of these are strands in the development of European thought that made possible the great Renaissance with a capital R, which certainly surpasses all the others in the sense that it never ended. The others all kind of fizzled or
– they ebbed and flowed.
They ebbed and flowed. But this one, the Renaissance with a capital R, it led to the Reformation. It led to the Enlightenment and to the modern world. And so we certainly
– basically, it's still going on.
Yeah. Well, we hope. as long as there are programs like this that ask these wonderful questions, and as long as people are asking questions and not taking other people's word for it, then the Renaissance is continuing.
Okay. So out of this Renaissance, we eventually get the Age of Reason. And many of the disciplines of the Greeks were dropped or changed, weren't they?
Yes.
Can you tell us which ones and why?
Well, I'd love to. and one of my favorite subjects is astrology. Now, I'm about to make comments, and I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I'm not a believer in or a practitioner of astrology, and I will not cast your horoscope, even though I can. according to the ancient methods, which were far more scientific than the methods today, and I've what fascinates me about astrology, though, is that ancient astrology is that it was part of an entire intellectual system that involved medicine. It involved natural philosophy, physics. Aristotle really is the one who unified all of human thought into this grand system. So, the physics, Aristotle's physics, were useful in talking about medicine, and astrology, you got the idea of the connectedness between the planets and life on the earth. It's compatible with Aristotelian physics. And all of this fit together in a grand system that was just beautiful to contemplate. There's nothing like it today. We are fragmented in our – we have one set of theories to think about one thing and another to think about another. You know, medicine doesn't necessarily relate to religion although there are attempts to try to bring them together. And certainly theology is way out in another place. But what fascinates me is how people could think, how people could operate their lives with this grand system. And when Christianity comes along – a lot of it becomes associated with Christianity. So during the Middle Ages, you have all of this, you have astronomy, astrology, and medicine and physics, all part of this grand system. Well, during even before the Renaissance, I mean, people didn't always accept astrology. There were critics of it all along. And what most of the critics were criticizing was the idea that you could predict, you could give somebody's fate on the basis of a chart. But everybody, all the way down to the Enlightenment, all thinkers seemed to accept the idea that there was a sort of natural astrology, that the heavens do have an influence on the earth. It's just that we can't know it precisely enough to predict anything. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the moon influences the tides, you know, and that sort of thing. They also, by the way, used to think that the planets caused the metals to grow in the ground. Metals grow just like plants and I mean, according to this ancient way of thinking, they're nurtured in the ground, and
rather than just always being there, and you have to discover it.
Right, right. I mean, there were actually people who thought that. Well, what if we could plant seeds in the ground, and after a few centuries, maybe we'd have a gold deposit there? Okay. I wish. So it's this whole grand system that fascinates me. And the way that it falls apart, of course, is during the Enlightenment when people like Galileo begin to question some of the metaphysical bases of the physics. And then when the authority of the church gets questioned and you have the advancement of skepticism, which I'm all in favor of as long as it's healthy. I mean, skepticism keeps us on our toes, but when it purposes to destroy and tear down,
Remember in one of your articles in the Byzantine Empire, a princess was allowed to be educated, but not grammar, not Greek grammar.
Oh, yes.
Why was that?
Well, actually, we're talking about Anna Komnina, and she died in about 1150. She belonged to the Komnenos dynasty, or if you pronounce that correctly, it's Komnenos. She belonged to the Komnenos dynasty, which was the patron of one of these renaissances of thought in Byzantium. Her father was also a military usurper who stepped in to prevent the empire from falling apart further. But she was actually not permitted to study any of this stuff, but she did it on the sly. Byzantine princesses were supposed to marry and to use their status for political advantage for the family and so on.
Be an influence.
Yeah. But this woman, Anna, had a remarkable mind and she would not be put down. And so she cajoled palace eunuchs to teach her Greek culture, language, and so forth. The restriction on grammar was because the texts through which one would learn grammar were associated with the stories of Zeus and the ancient gods, and we all know how immoral Zeus was, sowing his Olympian oats everywhere. These kinds of stories were considered pornographic and not appropriate for a good Christian. I didn't mention a very important situation in the Christian interaction with Hellenism. Hellenism came as a complete package. You had the philosophy and the science, but you also had the mythology. You also had the gods. You also had all of this stuff that, like I said, was considered immoral, and they weren't able to separate it. The Muslims were able to do that, and that's why what the Muslims did creatively to Hellenism helped eventually the Christian West to accept it. They weren't interested in the gods and all that. They were interested in the intellectual tools. Well, anyway, Anna was able to acquire such a great education that she was able to write one of the most brilliant histories of her father, one of the most brilliant histories of the Middle Ages, period. Written by a woman in the 12th century, it happens to be about her father. And it's loaded with allusions to Homer and Thucydides and Aristotle. She knew about every aspect of Hellenistic thought.
So coming full circle, how is Hellenism or Greek thought still influencing Western society today?
Well, I think it's influencing our society in subtle ways because I think that most people are unaware of the full debt that we have in science, philosophy, theology, and every department of human thought, the debt that we owe to Hellenism as transformed through every phase, the Byzantine phase, the Roman phase, the Islamic phase, it was created, and the Western European phase through the church, it was creatively transformed at every point. It is at the basis of, like I say, at the basis of all of our intellectual endeavors. What fascinates me, however, is how little truly original ideas we come up with today in terms of fundamental philosophical ones. The Greeks thought of so much in the formative period of this Greek miracle, for example. Of course we come up with new ideas today, but a lot of it was already thought of. And the example that I use with my students is atomism. atomism, the idea invented by the ancient Greeks that the world is made up of these indivisible things. I mean, we even use the term atoms today, these indivisible things, and there is no God. There doesn't need to be a God because these atoms come together by themselves and they make possible the multifarious complexity of the world as we experience it. Well, Aristotle didn't like that idea because it flew in the face of experience. You know, how can – for him, it was too reductive. How can the complexity of the of experience phenomena be explained by these subatomic – or these atomic particles, right? And his whole – in a sense, Aristotle's whole system that involves a universe of purpose, a universe of causal connections and so on was a grand refutation of atomism. Well, we find atomism today. We find – in the – one of the problems that I had with physics, my interest was in these grand unified field theories and so on. And what they attempt to explain everything on the basis of quantum mechanics. I mean they even call it the theory of everything, mm-hmm. right?
I've heard that.
Yeah. Well, I realized that that's a crock. It's a rhetorical crock, and I think they're after funding or something, and the capturing the public consciousness. Well, they don't explain everything. It explains some things. You know, there's wonderful things to be found in subatomic physics, but it's not going to explain a human being. It doesn't explain beauty. So there's something else going on. But the Greeks – see, Aristotle and the atomists already had that battle 2,500 – well, almost 2,500 years ago. But most physicists today I think probably haven't read their Lucretius and haven't read their Leucippus and haven't read their Aristotle.
Well, I know at one point in both public and private education, the classics were required. The study of Greeks and Romans, the study of Aristotle and Cicero and Homer – that was all required study just to get your general. Mm-hmm. Have we wandered away from that in our private and public education?
I think we have, and if I comment too much, I'm sure that there'll be public outcry.
You can give your opinion.
Well, okay, what I'm about to say is from the perspective of somebody who acquired his Greco-Roman classics through hard work and through much intense labor, and so I do I value these things as precious, as I sacrifice so much to get them. I believe that we have wandered away from our intellectual heritage, and I think it would be too much to ask for us today to re-require Greek and Latin languages and so on in our schools. I would love to see more emphasis placed on them, and I think there is some optimism. There is a resurgent interest in Latin in our age, and it's partly facilitated by the fact that we now have the internet. We now have electronic means of transmitting and sharing texts and techniques to teach Latin. There's a well-known publisher of Latin pedagogical materials from my hometown in Illinois. It's Bolchesi Carducci. I mean, I know Lou Bolchesi. We're acquainted. They produce wonderful materials for use in homeschooling and for use for high school students that are interested in learning Latin. And even if a student is able to have a year or so of Latin, it trains the mind. It enables their English vocabulary will skyrocket. Their scores will soar on the ACTs and the SATs if they have even a little bit of Latin. Now, Greek is asking probably too much, but the in terms of vocabulary, what we really have in English from Greek is like medicine and so on. But Latin is everywhere. I've said too much. Edit that out.
No, you're doing great.
To get my he's now 13 years old. I tried to get my 10-year-old son interested in studying Latin, and he did for a while, but he's more interested in basketball and tennis and all this. But he does have a basis, and I think eventually he'll come round, and, you know, I'll teach him that I'll teach him Weenie Weedy Weeky, right, you know, Caesar and all that.
Well, in one of your papers, you called for further studies regarding the Byzantine Empire at Brigham Young University.
Yeah.
And what value do you see in that for your students?
Well, I see it twofold value. One is from the historical perspective, because the Byzantine Empire bridged the time between antiquity and the Renaissance.
Probably more than we know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a big hole in most education because it's not covered. It's not a popular subject yet in America.
It's not Western culture.
Right. It's not
so
Western. Right. It's not Western culture. It's weird. I mean, Westerners consider them a little too Oriental for our tastes, and the Muslims think that, of course, from that perspective, the Byzantines are too Christian. Right. So they don't really fit. But they. As I said, they carry the civilization from the ancient Romans up to the Renaissance, and they impinge on so many other cultures, Balkan cultures, Russia. They're a link to all these areas. So that from one perspective, the historical perspective, it's very useful for the basis of the Middle Ages. Another perspective, which is particular to Latter-day Saints, is that it is a Christian civilization. It is a civilization that has a continuity back to early Christianity. Now, you can argue, and I think Latter-day Saints would argue about what kind of continuity is there with the really, really early church. I'm not going to get into that, but...
Well, I think it's interesting that the church in Rome, when they celebrate Easter, they have ham, but the church in the East, they still have lamb.
Right.
For Easter.
That's right.
So...
But I use what I'm trying to drive at here is that I use Byzantium as a vehicle for teaching LDS students about the beautiful Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, which has so much of a beauty to offer to Western Christians to think about. They're in terms of the divine liturgy, in terms of the ceremony, in terms of the doctrines. I mean, they even have a doctrine of theosis, of divinization, the belief that our purpose through salvation is to become divine like Christ. These are things that are available in Western Catholic Christianity, but you really have to dig for them. In the Eastern tradition, they're there. And in many regards, I think they preserve an earlier form of Christianity. And all of my students, I think, that take my Byzantine history class come out of there with a deepened appreciation of this beautiful Christian tradition.
Well, and I think that there's value in learning all of these traditions. I've had experiences just because of my little bit of understanding of Buddhism. I was able to talk with a young man from Korea and open his eyes a little bit more. And so there's value. I really do believe that there is value in learning all of these things. It opens doors for us and helps us to speak to other people of other cultures and other ways of thinking that we can connect.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that often Latter-day Saints are accused of being ignorant of other traditions. You know, they don't know anything about us. So, I mean, if I was Orthodox missionaries came and they were just interested in preaching their own version of Christianity without knowing anything about my own, I wouldn't be as inclined to listen to them.
True.
It helps, as you say, it helps to open conversations.
Well, excellent. Well, Dr. Cooper, thank you so much for being with us here today on Insights. This has been wonderful.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
You can continue your road to learning and discovery by visiting our website, radio.lds.org, where you can check out other programs and sign up to receive podcasts. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. I'm Marilee Stallings.